Log Talk Radio.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white.
Hey, Marie, it's me, Wayne Klingman, with, once again, the best crime show you can find online, at least I think so. And with our great guest today, I'm sorry, we have a guy knocking on the door. He wants me to sign something. So you have to forgive me for this interruption. This is unplanned for. But why don't you tell us about yourself, our guest, sir, please?
Well, I'm a former Navy veteran.
Thanks.
And I had spent 3 years in an intelligence unit. And during the course of my tenure, obviously, in different capacities, I began taking an interest in, like, crime, obviously, you know, organized crime structure, and that followed me to when I pursued my education and received my master's degree. I became involved in researching the counter cultures, and eventually one of my professors kind of gave me some background on that information, which led me to an investigation in the 1960s on a Milwaukee riot, and then later when I spoke to a former detective to the Outlaws Motorcycle Club in Milwaukee in southeastern Wisconsin.
Well, you were my first guest. I really, really appreciate you coming on and talking to me about your great book, You Gotta Be Dirty. And I thank you for picking up the face and signing for my packages from the UPS guy, evil man that he is. That you have an incredibly well-done, real researched book. And I want to thank you again for writing it and coming on my podcast. And I understand from off the air before we got on that you're all taking some time to travel the country and sign the books and do other appearances. How's that been going over? Is that going over pretty good for you?
Sure. I think there's a lot of people who have some interest in the biker subculture because they watched a couple episodes of Sons of Anarchy, and so they have some kind of idea what these groups are about. Now, Sons of Anarchy is obviously a show which has some truth to it, but it's fictional. Some of the things in it obviously are not real depictions of the way these groups would operate. But these people have some certain perceptions, and so when they speak to me, I'm able to either confirm their perceptions or hopefully educate them a little bit further about what these clubs are really about, especially the organized crime and some of the racial and gender components as far as the treatment of women. So I was in Chicago outside Wrigley Field the other day signing copies at a pretty decent crowd, probably about maybe 24 people that came. And I've been in the Twin Cities area in St. Cloud signing some books as well. And I think the book is getting a pretty good response.
Wonderful. I know from people who listen to the show, they really enjoyed hearing about you writing a book and other topics that we brought up. I really appreciate you coming back again for more of it. Now, again, when I imagine organized crime, right, I imagine people in suits in an Italian restaurant around the table, you know, perhaps have Marlon Brando, you know, being the godfather again, but, you know, sort of a thing, right? But I don't think of motorcycle gangs as organized crime, but yet they are very much organized crime, are they not?
Yes, in fact, if you look at La Cosa Nostra, the five Italian crime families in the United States, and you look at the Russian Mafia and MS-13, which is a Hispanic group that's based in El Salvador, those are groups that are organized crime imports into the United States. But outlaw motorcycle gangs are America's only organized crime export. And these, you know, the Outlaws, for example, the Outlaws Motorcycle Club formed in Wisconsin, and Louisville and Chicago is an outlaws nation in 1964. But by the, you know, late 1970s and early 80s, these groups began to expand internationally. And the Outlaws now have 124 chapters in 23 countries that are all over the world, in Asia, Australia, all over. In fact, Germany has some of the most chapters of the club in the entire world. And so you can see how these groups expanded. And what they really are is organized crime on a global scale. Now, that being said, most of the politics of these clubs are local, and they usually revolve around regions or states. And in Wisconsin, obviously, Wisconsin is what's called the gold region of the outlaws. And so that's where most of the politics is there locally, but this local politics can also affect the national or international landscapes of these groups.
Wow. Now, when I think international organized crime, which you obviously described, that means they're doing perhaps an operation in Germany that will ultimately benefit the club of the United States. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes. In fact, one of the instances in the 1990s where the outlaws were involved in is they were stealing Harley Davidsons and breaking in the garages and stealing them. And then what they were doing is shipping them to Russia and Germany. One of the investigators that used to work for the Milwaukee Police Department later after he retired had a job at Harley Davidson, and his job was to trace some of these motorcycles. So they're literally shipping these bikes overseas, and they have contacts in all these countries because they have chapters there. So it gives them kind of an inroad right away to the local organized crime network in those countries.
So it could easily be that Wayne Klingman with his nice new Harley that just cost something back, you know, tens of thousands of dollars potentially, gets stolen and ends up in the streets, say, in Moscow, Kiev.
It could. You know, there's two ways they generally do it. They'll try to ship the bikes overseas. It's a little more difficult proposition. You obviously have to have some contacts to maneuver around the customs system. But another thing they'll do is Harley-Davidson are generally stamped with the VIN number on three major parts. So what they can also do is cannibalize the bike once they get it and break it down and then take these other parts and sell them at swap meets or sell them to other dealers at a discount. And so Harley-Davidson parts business becomes, you know, it's obviously a big business. And because those parts aren't stamped, it's oftentimes difficult for law enforcement to approve.
Oh, absolutely. And now with the rise of 3D printing, they have that ability to go and supply parts for stolen vehicles.
Right. So
wow.
That's one of the things they did, too. Remember, they operated the chop shops. They had two big operations going on in Milwaukee. One actually was in Waukesha County. One was in the north side of Milwaukee, where they would obviously go to a junk show, go to an auto show where a car that's basically been sold out and buy it for $500, and then steal a similar car and then switch the VINs, the vehicle identification numbers, and sell those other cars at a discount, but still make a lot of money. In fact, the outlaws were running the chop shops they were running in the 1970s. What happened was that about 15,000 cars a year were stolen in the city of Milwaukee. But the recovery rate dropped by 5% because of these chop shops, which is about 500 cars a year. And so the insurance industry lobby in Washington felt that this was such a significant cost to them that they actually funded an FBI task force to investigate these chop shops, which is one of the ways that the Milwaukee Police Department and the ATF task force developed information on the Larry Anstead bombing. Because that bomb was made at one of the chop shops in Waukesha County.
Right, and of course, when you hurt, be more mercenary for a second, and when you hurt big business and they have the resources, they're going to fund a lot of resources into organizations that can, you know, stop them from losing that amount of money. It's got to be a huge, huge, huge loss for them.
It is, and you know, and one thing when the federal government is really begins to investigate something, cost really is not that much of an option for them. I mean, first of all, if you look at local law enforcement, they have budgets, and states and local governments can't print money or borrow exorbitant amounts of money. Well, the federal government can. And so if the federal government has you as a target and you're an organized crime group, they'll spend as much money and as much resources as necessary it is to take you down. And that's the difference when a local agency is involved compared to a federal agency where they can assemble a task force and just bring an unlimited amount of resources to the table.
Well, or not, I mean, I feel bad for the smaller communities that face the horrific problem with that of opiates and opiate addictions, because how do they even begin to fight, or meth, how do they even begin to fight the operation when they might have as few as, say, 10 officers? You know,
right, well,
there's
a state division of narcotics under the Department of Criminal Investigation that will assist these local jurisdictions with agents and resources, too. But then again, you know, they have limits. They have budgets as well. Unless it becomes a thing where the drugs are crossing state borders, then the feds probably aren't going to get involved unless there's a large amount of narcotics that's recovered.
Right, absolutely. Because we all have, as to the federal government, we all have things that we can't straight out of the most. I understand. It's my understanding, and perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong, please, is that right now the FBI is really, really tied up with investigations into terrorist threats in the country. And many operations have to be put on standby for the time being as these things are more looked into. Do I understand that correctly, sir?
Yes, well, the FBI really doesn't investigate the bikers very much. The bikers have really been relegated to ATF because the bikers use explosives and firearms. So in Milwaukee, the ATF agent that was in charge of the investigation, I think he's Ms. Sandra DeVolcanier, and she actually had an ATF task force that she led that was comprised of state and local officers. The FBI really has gotten out of investigating the crime business pretty much in the 1990s after the first World Trade Center bombing. And what happened was that President Clinton then offered local law enforcement agencies COPS grants so that they could actually expand their departments with federal money, because he knew he was easing the FBI out of the crime business to focus on terrorism.
Right. I mean, that's how we have our local COP officers, community-oriented police officers, paid for by that federal grant. Yeah, it helps us get manpower that we need desperately in Racine to stop some people becoming criminals, you know, before they get started. You know, then they work with the youth to help them, steer them into different paths versus, you know, that life of crime. Right, good thing that we have them.
Yes.
So now, as I discussed off there with you briefly, that it was my reading a couple articles online that Montreal seems to be having a little bit of a bikie war with what's going on with arsons. And you talked with us already about organized crime. I take it that, and going around the world, but I take it that Hells Angels has been in a presence in Canada for some time, correct?
Yes, I mean, Canada has always traditionally had a much larger even biker problem than the United States. The reason being is that if you look at the population of Canada, about 90% of Canada's population lives within about 100 miles of the U.S. border. And so these clubs compete for very little turf, even though there's a number of them, to gain influence in these areas. And so these rivalries will really take place. You know, they've been using explosives. I just read an article the other day. There was a raid done on the Black Pistons, which are the Black Pistons are kind of like the Outlaws Farm Club. They're an Outlaws affiliate in the Ontario area, where they cover numerous firearms. And as you know, in Canada, people aren't able to possess firearms in Canada. They have strict gun control laws. So even though they have those there, the bikers still get their hands on guns. And in Canada, they have used explosives. There was a situation there in about 2000, where a group called the Rock Machine decided to patch over to the Bandidos. Now, the Bandidos, obviously, the same group that was involved in the Twin Peaks shooting in Waco, Texas. So you can see the influence of these clubs all trying to gain access to the Canadian markets. And so later on, some of the Rock Machines, people dropped their patches. There's a lot of politicking going on in Canada. But Canadians have always had a problem. In fact, in my book, I mentioned the case of a man from Kenosha. His name was David Michael Marshall. In his case, in 1978, he was found in a Outlaws clubhouse in Quebec. And what happened was that they suspected he was sent there as an enforcer to take action against the Hells Angels, who just killed an Outlaws member. Eventually, he came back to Wisconsin and got picked up on a gun case. And then the federal government learned that he was actually a national enforcer for the Outlaws right in Kenosha.
Damn, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, well, you know, these groups transcend state lines. And so even though, like I said, the politics is somewhat local, they will bring in people from the outside whenever they feel they need to. In the book, I also mentioned a case where one of the Outlaws regional president, Kevin Rogers in Chicago, was shot. And what happened was the Outlaws had brought in a number of people to go to this track in Indiana. They had issues with a group called the Invaders, but also because of the shooting that involved their regional president. And when a vehicle was stopped, there were six Outlaws inside. They found like 10 weapons and some smoke grenades and things like this. One of the people present was a guy named Clarence Smith, who was actually one of the regional presidents from Florida. And he was an interesting guy. They obviously brought this guy in for the right reason. He was the only man that ever was imprisoned on Louisiana's death row that it was actually freed. And he was suspected of one homicide in New Orleans and four death investigations in the Florida area. And so you can see that by his presence there, the importance of what was going on, the call to arms kind of that the outlaws are putting on. They
right.
brought him in from the outside, just like the outlaws in Montreal brought in David Michael Marshall back in 1978.
Wow. Now, this organization must need an awful lot of money to maintain their existence. You know, moving people around state lines, the legal issues that they have, the lawyers that they must hire in order to try to keep them out of jail. How do motorcycle gangs today, in your opinion, fund themselves?
Well, if, you know, in the book I mentioned how outlaw motorcycle gang women, women are not allowed to join the club. In fact, in many instances, they're considered property. They're either old ladies or mamas. Mamas belong to the entire club. Old ladies belong to a specific member. But many of these women, they work in topless bars, and their goal is to earn money for the club. Oftentimes, the clubs will go in there and gain them employment by strong-arming the owners. There's been instances reported like that. So, in essence, there was a study done in one Mississippi city where, in three Mississippi cities, where every table dancer in those cities was working for an outlaw motorcycle club. So that's one way they gained. The other thing is, there's a report in my book where in 1981, the DEA indicated that the Outlaws Motorcycle Club in Wisconsin controlled the meth market. Obviously, they run these chop shops, and they deal in Harley-Davidson parts. They also are involved in counterfeiting. There was a case I mentioned in the book where an Outlaws member who was arrested in Louisville, he was out on bail for stealing Harley-Davidsons in Wisconsin. And he was caught trying to traffic $50,000 in counterfeit 20s. So the rackets, as we call them, if you're working with the Cosa Nostra, there are a vast number of rackets, and every subgroup within that organization has their own rackets. Sometimes when they step outside their rackets, that's when they get into trouble. One of the people I mentioned in the book was a guy named Michael Drobach. His nickname was Rerun because he had to repeat his probationary time with the Outlaws. Well, Michael Drobach trafficked stolen automobile parts. He was involved in a chop shop over on near 35th and Bleet, Milwaukee. And what happened was he tried to pad his income by selling narcotics from a local tavern. And what happened, of course, obviously, law enforcement got a source in to buy drugs from him. And eventually he was taken down, and because of his record, he was looking at a possible 20-year sentence. And the Outlaws obviously felt that he might turn informant. And one day they visited his house, and Drobach, his wife, and their 10-year-old son were all shot to death. So you know, these are the various rackets that they apply, and sometimes they're very good at what they do, but when they try to get greedy, either by stealing too many cars or stepping outside their area of expertise, that's generally where they get in trouble.
Right. And just like any other organization, criminal or straight, I expect they're getting into more computers, more cyber-type stuff, using mobile, you know, to stay current. Would I be correct when I assume that?
Yes, definitely.
Wow, this is incredible. Now, where can we go and find your book if we have not gotten a copy yet?
Amazon.com is the best place. It should be starting to appear in some local bookstores. I just don't know when or which stores. I can kind of go through my publishers told me that they should start materializing now. They have to remain on Amazon for 30 days before they can be disseminated to bookstores. It's kind of the policy of the company. So they should be appearing locally, but anybody can go to Amazon and pick up a copy. It's there on Amazon in book form. If you're like me, I like the you know, dead tree version of books. Or if you like the electronic form, it's available on Kindle too.
Absolutely. I have to tell you, anymore with the Kenosha fulfillment plant we have, I can order a book on a Monday, and most likely will be sent to my front door on a Wednesday. So please, 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 if you've not gotten a copy, you got to be dirty. You got to go and get one, and you got to order it today for this great man to be able to continue to write his great books and going towards. Please, please, please. Now, you're on Twitter too, correct?
Yes, Sam, on Twitter, my handle is Predicate X.
Okay. And you have a Facebook page, I understand?
I do have a Facebook page set up, same handle. If you look at Predicate X, there should be a book, a page set up that's dedicated to the book. Been active now for about 2 weeks. I enjoy answering questions. A lot. Some people have sent in messages to me asking me certain questions about the groups. I'm glad, more than glad to speak about them and inform people about these groups. It brings up some interest. Sometimes they'll have questions about some things in the book. They feel like we're kind of they're left hanging. Well, obviously, the history of the book kind of stopped around 2000, year 2000. So some of those things are still out there, which, eventually might appear in a follow-up book.
Outstanding. When will you see a follow-up book, sir?
I would say it's probably going to be a couple of years. I try to, like, professional historians always say that at least 15 years should pass because you want to be able to look at all the documents you can compile and place these kind of activities in their historical context. So that's what I try to do. It's also a bit more difficult to get information in short term from the federal government. As you may know, the Privacy Act really prohibits researchers from getting access to the documents regarding people who are still alive without their consent. And the chances of the outlaws consenting to having a researcher look at government documents about them is going to be slim to none. And so as these people pass and I can show a death certificate, these documents become much easier to get. As such, the history is going to be much more detailed and better.
Absolutely right, which is understandable because we want our privacy to be somewhat protected. But with the passage of time, the documents become available and relevant to what's even going on today. Because I find that really haven't broken out of many of the problems that the outlaw-type motorcycle gangs have given us, have we?
I think the culture's been kind of reined in slightly because the Patriot Act, which a lot of people complain about some of the flaws regarding the Fourth Amendment, but one of the provisions the Patriot Act really did, and I think was really beneficial, was it tightened the laws on explosives and increased the penalties for explosives to the point where that if you detonate any type of explosives and someone's injured, you're looking at really much a 25-year sentence, and if someone dies, you're looking at life in prison. And so that really reined in the use of explosives for the outlaws, which was their signature. That's what they used for, since the 1970s to target rivals. That's Larry Anstett case. His anniversary is coming up November 5th. It was November 5th, 1974, almost 42 years ago, when he was delivering newspapers and actually picked up a package meant for an outlaw's rival that detonated and killed him. Kind of a tragic case because when you talk to some of the old school investigators that were there, they claim that he was killed instantly, but his face was still smoldering. They could smell his flesh burning when they got to the scene. It's one of those cases that just they know who is. They have a suspect. One of the things I did unearth in my book is a still living co-conspirator. It was believed, at least publicly, that the suspect, John W. Bushman, had killed all the co-conspirators. But I was unable to unearth some documents to show there is still a living co-conspirator. I'm hopeful that down the road somewhere that this may lead to actually a prosecution.
Yeah, because the young boy that got murdered deserves justice. Absolutely. And I'm very pleased that, you're correct, there's some problems with the Patriot Act, but if we have a law in the books that prevents people from being bombed and innocent people from being hurt, I'm going to support that part of the law, no doubt about that.
Yeah, it really has. If you look at these motorcycle gangs in the United States, look at the use of explosives, how it's really reined in. Even La Cosa Nostra, if you look at Cleveland, Milwaukee, and other places where they use explosives, obviously the mob isn't what it used to be, but these groups have really scaled back in use of explosives. It's just not worth it. Anything you do, looking at economic opportunity costs, obviously before you do something, you're going to weigh the consequences and see if it's worth doing it. The laws against explosives now are so draconian that these groups have decided that they're just going to put them on the shelves and not use them.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, you're not going to do it. You're not going to, in my opinion, I'm no expert, I'm not going to commit a crime that's going to give me 20 years without long and hard thought. Is it going to be worth it? And most of the other times, I'm going to be thinking, no, I can figure some way out of the situation. Yeah. So where are the hotbeds, in your opinion, of the illegal, of the outlaw-type motorcycle clubs active today?
Well, they're active everywhere, but the key is that when they really start to become problematic is when there's conflict either between their own members or with other clubs. Right now, in Rhode Island, they have a conflict coming because the Outlaws have a probationary chapter they're opening up there, and the Hells Angels have a presence in Rhode Island. If you look at some of the articles online, you know, law enforcement there is on high alert. There's also an incident this past weekend in Key West, Florida, where a group with Outlaws colors went and kind of busted up a bar down there. You know, on occasion, what happens is that people that aren't familiar with the culture, when they see these guys come in, they start acting rude, they call them on it. And then, obviously, the Outlaws push back. Usually, the Outlaws have more members there than the person who's calling them on it, and these type of incidents happen. So, in a sense, it's kind of important to know about the subculture. You kind of have a feeling about what these guys are about, because before you engage in one of them verbally, you're going to want to know what you're stepping into.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, I mean, I'm an old man now, and I expect, I don't go to bars, but I expect if I was in a place I saw a bunch of outlaws or other motorcycle types show up with jackets, I'm thinking it's time for me to go someplace else.
Exactly. You know, it's funny advice my dad gave me when I was a kid. He said that he didn't expect me, if I saw somebody doing something that was kind of like a victimless crime, he didn't expect me to necessarily report it, but he expected me to leave and get out of there before bad things happen. And so that's part of your judgment as you move into adulthood. But when you see these guys coming, like the best thing you can probably do is just leave.
Yeah, leave and maybe, I don't know, call the local police and say, I got, this is what I'm seeing. You might want to look into it. You know, that might help them, you know, get heads up on a potentially bad situation.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, especially if there's animosity in the air, definitely want to make sure that you get out of there and contact somebody so they can check it out.
Yeah, I know back when I was in the military back in the day, we're talking 30-some years ago down in Fort Hood, I always wanted to know where the strippers came from because they all weren't going to – I didn't think they were all the farm girls looking to make it big in the big city, right? It's interesting to know that maybe some of them came from outlaw-type motorcycle gangs. So now that we have strip clubs in Milwaukee, you know, I'm thinking, is that where those girls come from that do that job?
Right. Well, I'm sure some of them are just people interested in making money. And other ones are affiliated with the club. Obviously, to these women, they're somewhat allured to the motorcycle culture. And these groups also provide some sense of protection for them. You know, obviously not every stripper is going to be involved with all the motorcycle gangs, but many of them are.
Absolutely. And it's just, that's just a thing of curiosity of how, you know, people get involved. And I've been in film for some time. I can tell you all kinds of stories how what you hear in the film industry isn't initially very true at all. But it's interesting to know, too, that some of the stories you have heard do have an element of truth into it. But before we run up against this evil clock that's going to tell me to get the heck off the air in a second, let's hear again. Where can we best contact you, sir?
So the best way to get a hold of me is at Twitter, and my handle there is PredicateX. I also have a Facebook page with the same name, and you can send messages to that page. And I try to return them as punctually as possible if I'm not traveling. So I'd be glad to speak with people and communicate with them and tell them about these clubs.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and coming back in your in the show today. I apologize that I was interrupted by the UPS guy who made me sign for that package. Appreciate your cooperation in picking up that
no
piece
problem.
For me a lot better. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. The show will be up and posted in seconds, but I appreciate the listening. I appreciate the comments and the like. And with that, everybody, have a great day. And next week we'll have yet, I hope, another cool, exciting guest. Thank you very, very much, everyone. Bye-bye.